All right, here we go. We already started earlier before, but now we made it, you know, instead of once a week, talking about the history of the State of Israel. We're actually up to now the state just formed. Up until now, it was pre the state, but now the state forms, and feel free to add any information that you may have or any questions that you want to ask. So, Erev Shabbos, the 5th of Iyar, 1948, David Ben-Gurion declared the State of Israel in Tel Aviv, and we went on the trip, so we stopped to go to the bathroom. We went to the Kever of David Ben-Gurion, so I took a bunch of guys. I feel that he's probably the only prime minister that would have had the guts to go against basically all of international pressure, the United States included, saying don't declare statehood. And he did, and immediately upon declaring statehood, we were attacked. Five countries attacked us. Which countries attacked us?
Egypt.
Jordan, Syria. You proud of that, Mr. I'm from Egypt? Okay, Egypt, Jordan, Syria. Lebanon and?
Iraq.
Good. Okay. Here was a democratic international vote in the United Nations, and they rejected it. They went to war. 600,000 Jews, roughly, were living in Israel at the time. So a significant number. Throughout the Torah, we count how many Jews left in Shrine, about 600,000, how many Jews entered Eretz Israel, 600,000. There's a midrash that says there's something about that number, and here it is, we have 600,000 Jews living in Eretz Israel. And in 1967, when we conquered Har HaBayit, so then we had 600,000 soldiers in the IDF, right? The males, about 20, like we have in Parsha. Anyway, 600,000 Jews are living in Israel. If you combine those five nations, about 45 million Arabs, that attack. And yet, the Jews won. And it's really nothing short of a miracle. Feel free to grab chairs or sit on the windowsill. That's fine as well. Or on the floor is also cool. But the victory was bittersweet. Okay, where we are right now, the old city, we lost the old city of Jerusalem, including access to the Kotel. This fell into the hands of the Jordanians.
A question.
Yes.
We lost it.
We had Jews living in here, and we were kicked out. The majority of Jews, the majority of people living in Yerushalayim were Jewish. We mentioned this earlier, that when they were trying to come up with this idea of making the two-state solution, partition plan. So all the areas are predominantly Jewish, going to go to the Jews. Predominantly Arab, go to the Arabs. Problem was, Jerusalem was predominantly Jewish. And no one would vote for that. So some United Nations, like a guy named Ralph Bunch, I think, or Branch, he redrew the borders of Jerusalem to include Ramallah, Beit Lechem, so that it would be like 45% Arab to 55% Jewish, instead of like the 80-20 that it was pro-Jewish, so that it would be close enough to say, okay, Jerusalem would be an international city. That's what it was supposed to be. But now we lost it. Now, there's no longer an international city. It fell into the hands of the Jordanians. And the Jordanians trashed everything. They destroyed shuls, looted shuls. They took tombstones from cemeteries and used it to pave roads, and they didn't allow access into the holy sites, even though they were supposed to. After the war and after the peace treaty was drawn up, that didn't happen. So I'm saying, like, although we grew, that was a major loss for us. The War of Independence lasted for about 13 months, and about 6,000 Israelis died. Now, 6,000 Israelis, that's about 600,000. We're talking about 1% of the population. In the United States, if there's now close to 330 million citizens, that'll be like 3.3 million citizens dying. Right? When 52,000 Americans died in Vietnam, the country went crazy. So this would be 3.3 million people, 6,000 Jews. You should know that there were people after the war that wanted to reinstitute. Are you going to put on the air conditioner? Or open a window? Do you want to get a window? Okay. wanted to reinstitute the D'oraisa law that men can marry more than one woman. Why? Anybody just think about it?
Populating, yeah.
There weren't enough men. Of the 6,000 people that died, the dominant number is going to be marriageable aged men. So there were a lot of women around and not a lot of men. So even for Ashkenazim, when the Takkar of Rabbeinu Gershon was made, it was made for like 1,000 years. They said, oh, so let's let every man marry as many women as possible so that they're not sitting there just because there aren't enough men available. In the end, got voted down. And the law in Israel is still till today, if you already were married to more than one wife, you came from an Arabic country where that was permitted, you were allowed to come in with your multiple wives, but you couldn't marry a second wife in Israel if you were still married to your first wife. So there were people here in Israel that had multiple wives. I had a student once, his father was sitting on the shir, and he said his uncle had four wives. Right? Like, so this...
My friend's grandpa has two wives.
Right. Okay. So in some communities, people also have multiple wives, but it's one at a time, after a time, whatever, separate time. But here, it's like, here it was, you know, simultaneous. Simultaneous. It didn't happen. But now, Har Herzl is filled with graves that don't have names. Dude, this is an amazing thing. People came off the boats, displaced persons that got out of these camps, survivors of the Holocaust, and they were thrown into battle. And sometimes they do a first name, and you'll have, let's see, you know, like a tombstone that'll just say Shmuel. And sometimes it'll say Plony, because that's our John Doe. We don't know. We don't know who they are. They came and they fell in battle. And it's an amazing thing. Rav Soloveitchik was once asked in the early 1950s, the Agudah had a convention here in Eretz Yisrael. So we know Agudas Yisrael was formed in Europe, and the first convention actually got postponed because of World War I. Okay, Rav Kook had come from Eretz Yisrael to Europe to take part in the first convention, and World War I broke out, and Rav Kook got stranded in Europe. He couldn't get back to Eretz Yisrael for a few years. And through Hashgacha, part of the time he spent in England, he played a small part in getting the Balfour Declaration, you know, proclaimed. So I had a couple of conventions in Chutz La'atz, and now we have the State of Israel. So it was the early 1950s, and they're having a convention. I'm assuming it's King David. It was like, you know, some big hotel in Israel, and you had delegates means Rabbanim, from all sorts of, you know, all different countries, all around the world, they were meeting here. Now, what happened? Happened was the Israeli flag flies over the King David, and some people from Agudah, they weren't so pleased with being in a hotel with the Israeli flag flying overhead. But, you know, they couldn't exactly ask their host to take down the flag. They came up with an ingenious idea. They'll put all the flags from all the different countries where the rabbis are coming from. Okay. So then the Israeli press went to town. They said, the Union Jack, what's the Union Jack? The British flag. That's acceptable, but the Magen David is not. What's the Union Jack? That was the British, that had the British mandate, that patrolled the sea, that didn't let Jewish survivors of the Holocaust enter Eretz Yisrael, that turned them away, right? That sent them to DP camps, or in the case of the Axis, sent them back to Germany, right? That flag, that's okay. But the Israeli flag, that's possible. And people were all upset. So I go to Rav Soloveitchik. He was going to be speaking at some Mizrahi convention. And he said, yeah.
Why were people already then so upset about the flag and the whole idea of it?
Well, in the beginning, when the state first forms, everyone is pretty much like psyched. But after a couple of years, the way that my Rebbe Rav Kefet phrased it, they woke up one morning and they said, the bride is ugly. What does that mean? So you date this girl, and every time you ever see her, she's got all her makeup on, right? She's looking her best. At the wedding, she spent hours looking her best. And now you wake up the next morning, morning breath, her hair's a mess, and you look at her, there's no, and you go, whoa, that's why I'm married? Right? So he said, that's what happened here in Israel. In the beginning, there was ecstasy. Finally, we have our own place. Jews had a place after the Holocaust, and then people started looking at all of the problems. And they only keyed on the problems. They saw the glass half empty. And that's when you had people start saying, this is what we daven for. This is not what we daven for. You know, and that's where it starts. It took a couple of years. Didn't happen right away. A proof. The first election. All the religious parties ran together. The Haredim, the Dati Lumi, all together. They were one big party, religious party. Only one election that happened. By the second election already, everyone viewed things differently. Chabad. But, yeah. So...
Yeah, how does that prove that everyone...
In the beginning, everyone was very happy what happened, Baruch Hashem. Now, but then people started to pick on it. Now, so Lachik's answer was very strong. So Lachik's answer was, they totally misread the significance of the flag. Every country has a flag. Some sports teams have flags. Everyone, big deal. So you have a pennant. He says, but the Israeli flag is so much more important. And I've heard Rav Schachter speak about this here, and every time he speaks about it, he starts to cry, because that's who he is. Said that Rav Soloveitchik said, when the British pulled out, there was a race. Every hilltop, every building, whoever could capture that building, that would become, you know, Jewish territory versus Arab territory. So he said, Jews died putting a flag on top of a hilltop, putting a flag on top of a building. When we captured Harabayit, there were soldiers that went up there and unraveled a flag. And I said, what is some place, some museum now, someone told me they'd just seen the flag there. You know, Yitzhak Hanin went up there and they put a flag flying above the Kotel. So a flag had so much more significance because people lost their lives for that flag. And the halacha is that if you die, so you get buried in Tachrichim, shrouds. But if you're killed, you get buried in the clothing that you were wearing when you got killed. And it's Ma'or Rachamim, because Kadosh Baruch Hu looks and says, you know, this person was gunned down, this person was killed. Said Rav Soloveitchik, the flag of Israel is big day amaze. So many people gave their lives so that we can be here. That's the significance of the flag. You can see him crying, right? He's crying his head. Now, I want to read for you. Okay, I'll come back and say this one thing. I'll read for you this cool thing. The War of Independence was the costliest war that we had. The borders increased 30% from what originally was in the United Nations partition plan. As I said, the one downside is we lose the old city. It goes under whose rule?
Jordanian
rule. It's then that Jordan becomes Jordan. Up until then, the country is called Transjordan. What does Transjordan mean? Me'averlion, on the other side of the Jordan River. Because Jordan then was only on the eastern side of the Jordan. Once they took over Judea and Samaria, including the old city, it's now on both sides. So they dropped the trans and they became Jordan. They're right now back to being just Transjordan, but they kept the name. Sort of like the Los Angeles Lakers. Are they called Lakers? Because they started in Minneapolis. Whatever, fine. So they kept the name.
The old city
now,
is considered part of the West Bank?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
So there's no checkpoint where you have to go?
Okay. Because it's now part of Yerushalayim, right? And it was annexed and was part of... But when I started a yeshiva many years ago in Gilo, so it's over the Green Line, right?
Yeah.
So a parent calls me up, thinking of sending their kid. I go, is Gilo over the Green Line? I said, Gilo's in Yerushalayim. They go, oh, okay. That was it. I didn't lie. But we're over the Green Line right now as well. The Green Line, for those who don't know, I used to think the Green Line was because everything on our side was green, because we knew how to plant everything, and on the other side it was barren. No, just the pen that they used to make the line, the map, was green. You couldn't have called, you know, the black line, purple line, whatever it was. The green, and that's the Green Line. But for years, I look at the map and say, well, everything grows on our side. You know, it's nothing to do with that. I know that. That's why I thought that. But I'm saying, but that's not why it's called the Green Line. Anyway.
So the Green Line is ours?
Everything. Yeah, well, where they drew the map after this 1948 war.
What is saying about the... What is saying
about that one?
Yeah, it's really there.
Where this is part of Judea and Samaria. Okay. Now, there was a beautiful story that I photocopied in the Jerusalem Post. The author I know, he unfortunately lost a son who was in the army. It's not why he wrote this article, but he writes about the soldiers that came, like we said, from the Holocaust to fight in the War of Independence. Okay, I think of this every time we go to Har Herzl, which, you know, every year we go before Yom HaZikaron. Yeshiva takes us like a day or two beforehand, because on the day itself, it's impossible to have a tour around because it's packed with, you know, with Israelis that are paying their respects to the soldiers. Here's the story. The person who wrote it is a guy that I know from Ranana, Stuart Weiss. It goes like this. You might walk past it 1,000 times, even tread directly upon it, and yet you would probably never take note of it. Amid the silent hills and grassy quietude of Har Herzl, a gentle spring wind blows over the grave of one Baruch Shapiro. Barely an echo of his name remains. But the story of Baruch Shapiro now itself, buried by the years, begs to be retold. For a story mirrors the struggle of a whole people, encapsulating what it means to live and die as a proud Jew in the modern state of Israel. Baruch was the last remaining son of Chaim Shapiro, native of Krakow and survivor of Auschwitz. By a combination of faith, strength, and luck, Chaim lived through the unspeakable hell of the death camp and emerged from it along with son Baruch. Chaim's wife and 5 other sons were less fortunate. They perished together with the multitudes of Jews we now refer to as the 6 million. In a pitiful state, confused and shattered, father and son came here, along with thousands of other remnants of the ovens, to build a new life and reshape hope. But their dream of piecing together a new beginning would have to be delayed. Arriving on the shores of Palestine, young Baruch, now 18 years old, was handed a gun and a uniform and drafted into what would become the Israel Defense Forces. There were those who planned to finish what the Nazis had begun, and a new war was about to erupt. Chaim watched his son go off to war along with the other young men, and he tried to put his fears and foreboding out of his mind, busying himself with the difficult task of hewing out a place in the gritty new country, now battling for its first breaths of air. It was in the later stage of the War of Independence that Baruch Shapiro fell on the road to Jerusalem, defending the capital. He distinguished himself throughout the war and died guarding his post from enemy advance. When a young captain informed Chaim of the death of his son, the father uttered not a word. He simply nodded silently and folded the official notification over and over in his hand. Many hundreds of friends and comrades came to Baruch's funeral. The chief of staff, right, head of the army, was also there, for he had heard of the young man's distinguished service in his unit. An overwhelming sense of loss pervaded the day, for those assembled knew of the unique circumstance of the Shapiro family and wished to demonstrate the solidarity with the aging father whose family line had come to a sudden tragic end. During the brief ceremony, Chaim remained silent. He listened impassively as the appropriate tehillim and prayers were recited. His Baruch's commanding officer eulogized him as an exemplary soldier. But the flag-draped body was lowered into the grave, Chaim Shapiro suddenly began to sing, quietly first, and then more loudly. He sang Am Yisrael Chai, over and over. Then he began to dance, grabbing some of Baruch's friends and pulling them into a horror. The crowd looked on in horror, sure the father had lost his mind. Clearly, the enormity of the loss of the last remaining child had finally pushed him over the rim. Those standing close to the Chaim tried to calm him down, to console him. Chief of staff put his arm around him and urged him to sit down. But Chaim pushed the general away and carried on singing and dancing. After several moments, the elderly man turned to the crowd and began to speak. I am sure you think I have gone quite mad, he began. But I assure you that I am in complete control of my faculties. I know you think it's outrageous that I should sing at my boy's burial. But I want to explain why nothing could be more appropriate. The crowd stood mesmerized. You see, the father went on, when the rest of my family were murdered in Poland by the Germans, their lives ended in silence. They vanished in the wink of an eye. They were snuffed out like candles and no one saw or heard. No one took notice of who they were, what they had done, or what their lives had meant. To live and die in Poland was an empty and barren experience, containing only sadness and regret. was a waste of precious life. But this son, Chaim continued, pulling at the grave. This son is different, pointing at the grave. Chaim lived to walk upon the holy earth of Eretz Israel, and he died defending Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, a place we never dreamed we'd see in our lifetimes. Baruch gave his life for all the people of Israel, so they could be free and safe and independent. This is not a waste of a life. It is a celebration of a life. This is why I sing today. As I say, Shalom to my son. And this is why all of you should sing with me. With that, Chaim Shapiro began to sing, Am Yisrael Chai, once more. And the assembled throng began to join in, until every voice in the cemetery is raised in surrealistic song of sadness and joy, the tears of each emotion mingling on every face. For a long time, they sang thus together, till the hills of Yerushalayim themselves seemed to be joining in the chorus. You might walk past the grave of Baruch Shapiro a thousand times, even tread directly upon it, and probably take no notice. A gentle wind blows on the grave, and the story of Baruch Shapiro is no more than a fading memory, a distant echo. But the epic story of the Jewish people goes on unabated. It's a story written in the blood of our young men and women, on pages of pain and heroism, engraved in stone with quills from iron will. The story describes a profound stoicism and suffering, and that cannot be contained, must inevitably burst out into song and dance until we all affirm, Am Yisrael Chai. Alright, I was getting chills when I read that. I almost cried, but I didn't because I just said Rav Schechter cried, so I can't, I'm not on that level. Now, it's that, but that was a generation of people. That was a generation of people, right? Who went from surviving the Holocaust. Like, I really feel it's like an amazing thing. I wish I would have been alive at that time, because the two most important events in the last 1900 years happened in one decade. You know, maybe a decade of your grandparents, if not your great-grandparents. But this, you know, the Holocaust, worst thing that happened, and then the formation of the State of Israel. Like, two most pivotal events in the last 1900 years, ever since the Korban. And there were people that lived through it and went from one thing to the next. It's just really remarkable. Now, what happened was, with the United Nations vote, already Arabs started to get out of the country. They knew a war was coming. The wealthiest Arabs, they left right away. Right with the vote already. 30,000 Arabs left, because they had homes all over the place. They just went to their other home. With the beginning of the war, more Arabs come. Why? Because the Arab High Commission said, please get out of the way. We're going to go in, we're going to make mincemeat of the Jews. We don't want there to be collateral damage. So we're asking you to leave.
Collateral damage.
What?
It left collateral damage. They could blame on the Jews.
Okay, but they, no. They said, they thought this would be a cakewalk. They looked at the numbers and said, of course we're going to kill them. It's not like we even had a trained army. Right? What are the odds that we're going to win? So, in total, now the Arabs claim between 800 million and a million people left because they want them all to be able to come back. The United Nations said 472,000 Arabs left. Okay? 472,000 Arabs left.
Later killed.
We'll get to that later. The overall majority left before the war at the behest of Arabs. Okay, to be honest, there were some that were driven out, but that was a small few. One of the places, as in 1967, we drove out the Arabs from the Kotel Plaza and, you know, made that big plaza. Homes, as we know, went up to the Kotel, if you've seen any old pictures. Now, we resettled and we found places in Israel and kicked them out of the country. But there were people that were uprooted from their homes, but it was a small few. The over majority of these 472,000 left because they were asked to leave. Now, at the exact same time...
Where did they go?
They left the country. Okay, now, at the exact same time, 850,000 Jews were forced to leave Arab countries. Right? Many of you guys come from Arab countries. Okay, now, those of you from Persia, so that was different, and that didn't happen until the fall of the Ishan 79. But most of the Arab countries and Muslim countries got rid of all the Jews. They were upset, and they got rid of the Jews. So there was a mass exodus of Jews. 850,000 Jews were forced to leave their homes. A committee was formed, and it shows that over $300 billion was taken from these Jews. They were only allowed to leave with a certain amount of money and sort of like in a couple of suitcases. Over 100,000 square acres of land, 3.5 times the size of Israel, was left by Jews who were forced to leave. Okay? Why am I bringing this up? Because Arabs till today talk about the right of return, the refugees that had to leave, both in 48, later on, talk about in 67, and they should be able to come back. But what about the Jewish refugees? Right? More Jews were dislocated from their homes than Arabs. Okay? And that the Arabs never talk about, but it's something to keep in mind, yeah.
Can't they just say that it makes no difference to us just because they were bad to you? Does it mean you could do the same to us?
What do you say again?
Can't the displaced Arabs that were in Israel,
But as I said, here it's much worse. Here, the Arabs left voluntarily while, you know, his ancestors maybe were kicked out of Egypt.
Yeah.
That's a big difference. Yeah. And their land was confiscated. And their money was confiscated. If anyone has a stronger claim, it's the Jews who were kicked out of their countries as opposed to the Arabs who willingly left. Now, so I said in 48, we had about 600,000 Jews living here. How long do you think it took till we doubled in size? By 1956, we'd already doubled in size. Many of the Sephardi Jews from the Arabic countries came to Israel. So it was very difficult times, and we'll talk about it. Very difficult.
Yeah.
Country that's struggling to survive all of a sudden doubled in size, had to take in all of these people, had to provide people. It was a crazy time. Food is rationed, all sorts of stuff, just in order to take it down. One, you want the people to come, and the other hand, you had to provide the people. Very, very difficult. I won't get to that. But at 1.2, by 73 is at 1.8. Today, there's close to 7 million, right? In the 70, a little over 70 years since the beginning of the state, we went from, 600,000 to over 6.6 million. Then we're 6.8 or 6.9. You know, it comes out every year, there's a statistic, either on Rosh Hashanah, and then like, you know, by Yom HaTzimut. It's like, you know, there'll be a new statistics, and they, you know, write how many Jews. But there's more Jews living here than anywhere else, and pretty soon there'll be more Jews living here than the rest of Chutz La'aretz put together. Right? It won't be that long. And then there's even halachic differences, when you have majority of Jews living in Israel. But we're not that far from
What do you mean, halachic differences?
There's some people that maybe say Shemitah won't, you know, would be like Doraisa.
Wow.
Right? Certain things, Yovel, but and other things, people say it has to be, Jews have to be living in their ancestral areas. We know which Shvatim were from, so that might not happen to the Liyah. But I'm saying there is a concept of rogue Jews living in Eretz Israel.
Even at the time when, like, before the Bais were destroyed, Jews moved out of where they
By Cheney, we never had.
No,
we never had rogue Jews living here, only by Rishon.
By Rishon, they moved around, like, didn't
Yeah, but the majority of Jews are living in Eretz Israel.
From Dan move all the way up.
Yeah, but it's still a majority of Jews living in Israel. By Cheney, we didn't. We have more Jews living in Israel today than certainly during the time of Beit Cheney, probably during the time of Beis Rishon. World population was much smaller. I mean, just so it's possible that there are more Jews living in Israel now than ever before. That's just something to think about. It's an amazing thing. You want to say something? Okay. Now, this was not just a miracle. Can you open the window?
Yeah.
Not just a miracle, but it's the fulfillment of the Nevuot. Right? It says in Devarim, at the end of Devarim, and the Lord your God shall return you from your captivity and have compassion upon you. He shall return and gather you from amongst the nations, and the Lord your God will bring you back into the land your fathers inherited. He'll make you even more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. You know, this was read by our great grandparents and said, oh, halavai, one day, you know, we shall live so. We live this. We live it. Yirmiyahu says, and thus says God, shout with joy, Yaakov. Exult at the head of the nations, proclaim your praise, say, oh God, deliver your people, a remnant of Israel, behold, I will bring them back from the northern lands, gather them from the ends of the world. Right? We not only that, we made the desert bloom, as it says in Yechezkel. As for you, mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and bear the fruits of your people, Israel, for the return is close at hand. For behold, I am with you, I shall return you, you shall be tilled and sown, and multiply men upon you, the entire family of Israel. So we know, you're talking before, it's green here, right? Nothing was growing here before. Mark Twain traveled through here and said, it's a land that's cursed. It seems fertile, but nothing grows. Then we came here, and we make it grow. Right? We had stuff growing in Gaza, exporting all around the world. We left, the Arabs said, they can't get anything to grow. It's just that we see these miracles that we see. Israel is, every year, there's some sort of, you know, index in the United Nations, one of the highest standard, it counts the highest standard of living in the world. And always up there in the top 10 people that are happy in their lives. And this is with being surrounded by enemies that want to kill us. It's just really nothing short of remarkable. Yeah. Someone said something? Okay. Now, like I said, the Arabs, up until last week, their big claim was right of return, right of return. What's happened until last week? Because Trump basically threw it out. Okay?
What did he
say? He said, no right of return. What are you talking about? It's like all part of his you know, deal of the century. Now, the Arabs rejected before they even heard it. But he also said earlier, what do the United Nations do? Because the Palestinians, after they went to war, didn't accept the United Nations resolution of dividing up the land, they voluntarily left because their higher authority said, get out of the way. They then went and said, we should get a right of return to be able to return to our land in Israel, to return to our land. So the United Nations came up with Resolution 194 that says, refugees wishing to return to lands, and I'm emphasizing, and live at peace with their neighbors, right, should be afforded the permission to do so, or they should be compensated and be resettled somewhere else.
I'll give my house to an Arab.
What?
I'll give my house to an Arab and let you take
mine. Right. There was once when I was in BMT, so this Arab guy was working in the kitchen and said, I heard that Canada is a really nice place. What do you think? I think it's beautiful. You should bring your whole family. I told him. I said, really? Bring the whole neighborhood.
When was this resolution passed?
What?
When was this?
So it's in December 11, 1948. Okay? But it said, or there should be resettlement. Now, the resettlement, they never took up. You should know, today, where after 1993, the Oslo Accords, and the Palestinians are in charge of the area that, like, most of the Arabs are living in, they still maintain 19 refugee camps. And in Gaza, where Hamas has been in charge since 2007, there's 9 refugee camps. What does that mean? They still keep people, generations and generations and generations, not living in normal houses, but in refugee camps. Because the whole idea is to show the world how terrible Israel is. Right? Look, they're living in refugee camps, but they're in charge. They're actually in charge there. And they're still trying to blame it on us, and the world is bleeding, except for Trump. And there's billions of dollars that goes in. The United Nations, UNRWA, right, is for welfare for the Palestinians, refugees. Well, refugees. After World War II, there were 12.5 million Germans that were living in different countries for the Allies. And we just kicked out of the land. No one said, let's figure out what to do with the Germans. They're just kicked out. India and Pakistan was divided in half. And those Hindus who were, which one is which?
India is Hindu.
And
Muslim.
Yeah. So people who were found on the wrong side, because they're both such big countries, like 8 million and 6 million, I'm talking about a couple thousand here, they just transferred to the other country. So the easiest thing to say would be, all right, Arabs got kicked out of the land, Jews got kicked out of the land, we even had more, we'll just say, we're even. But that's never mentioned in the United Nations. In fact, every year there's a day dedicated to Israel banishing, like some Palestine Day. They talk about the plight of the Palestinian refugees. And Trump just said, we're going to stop giving money to this. It's ridiculous. right? He's like the only person. He's like the kid in the story that says, but the king is naked. You know, everyone else is praising the king for his new clothes, you know? But it's not right. So just Trump calls it like he sees it. And he says, what refugees? And why should we pour money into this? And why don't they take care of their own, like the Jews took care of their own? So this is like this whole issue with refugees. I'll give you a quote, Benjamin Franklin, in a letter to Richard Oswald. Okay, what happened was, there were loyalists from England who fled to Canada. The British wanted the newly formed republic to allow the loyalists to return to the United States. Benjamin Franklin wrote to him, your ministers require that we receive again into our bosom those who have been our bitterest enemies and restore their properties who have destroyed ours. In this world, the wounds they have given us are still bleeding. That's chutzpah. And that's exactly what's here. Right? The Arabs started, ran away, and demand a right of return. So any, you know, normal thinking person will say that's ridiculous. As Ben-Gurion put it, says, we won't accept refugees, not one refugee, just as our men who were killed in the Arab War against us will not rise up from the dead. I mentioned last week, one of the reasons why there's so many refugees is because the Jews didn't kill every Arab that they saw. They let them run away, as opposed to the Arabs who gunned down every Jew that they saw. So it says, when they come back to life, we'll let your refugees back. All right, we'll stop over here. Shkoyach, guys.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay.